Thanks, Roz. My name's Matty. I'm an addict. It's really nice that Roz asked me to do this chair. It's great to be here. I'm very nervous. I'm not used to talking to a microphone. I'm very nervous. I am nervous. I had an anxiety dream about doing this chair last night. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's also in the fellowship. I said, what am I going to talk about for 40 minutes? She said, you just go into a lot of detail. Just go into a lot of detail. And I just got a tip from someone else over there who also said, at 20 minutes, go on to your recovery. So I'm going to follow those two tips. Last week, actually, I was at this workshop for it was a bereavement workshop, and nothing to do with the charity, actually. It was a charity called Meningitis Research, and I went and did this bereavement day. And this woman, she was from the Child Bereavement Trust, and she did this amazing talk for 40 minutes with a big PowerPoint display. And I thought, God, how am I going to talk for 40 minutes? So I thought, I know what I'm going to do. I've seen people do this in other fellowships. I haven't seen it done in NA, so there's always a first. I wrote down some things in case I dry up, which could happen, I promise you. Anyway, so when you see me look at this piece of paper, it's because I'm losing it. Anyway, it's a hard act to follow. I loved, what was your name? Dennis's chair. It was great. I loved listening to it. So I feel kind of quite self-conscious. Anyway, I'm 19 years clean. I don't often say that, really, but I am. I thought, well, since this is this kind of meeting, I'm 19 years clean, and I think the most consistent thing I've done throughout my recovery is come to meetings. I've just kept coming back because I love coming to meetings, actually. I really enjoy hearing what people have to say. And like Dennis said, I feel I've heard you can learn so much from every different person in the room, whether it's a newcomer or 9 months or whatever. One of my sons was saying to me the other day, he said to me, how do you know when God's talking to you? You know, how is it? I've got a little five-year-old, and he's quite kind of comes out with lots of religious things, which surprises me, actually. But I said, well, you won't speak into your ears, but often you hear him talking through other people. And that's been my experience through meetings and through people out of the fellowship as well. When if I'm open to it, I can hear God speaking through other people. And, that's why I've kept coming to meetings, and not just keep coming back. That's all I can say. And I've seen a lot of people come and go and die since I've been around, and die. People I never thought would die. I went out with a guy who had this, as far as I was concerned, had such a fantastic step one, and about 8 years ago he OD'd. I was like, oh God. Because he started drinking again. Anyway, I'm not going to go into that now. I'm going to talk about myself and my story. I was born in London. I'm a Londoner. I grew up in Notting Hill Gate. And obviously, I haven't really left, haven't gone very far. Still live in northwest London. I was the youngest of four children. And I didn't have a particularly good childhood. It wasn't, in retrospect, it wasn't a good time. I was, the youngest of four, and I have the sister above me has Down syndrome, and basically, my parents split up when I was about three, and my sister with Down syndrome was in care, and why am I saying this? It's quite relevant to me. And my mum, being the woman she was, when she split up from my father, I was about three and a half, she kind of changed. I think getting married at 21 and having four children very quickly, very young, she wanted to let her hair down. And their relationship broke up, And honestly, it probably was in a matter of weeks, my mother had moved this guy in who was later to become my stepfather. And it was the 70s, late 60s, 70s. It was a kind of hippie, grew up in this hippie environment. My sister with Down syndrome was in care, and we never saw her again. We weren't allowed to talk about her. And it was just a very painful, difficult time from having a mum who was kind of normal. This guy moved in, my stepfather, and it went into full-on 70s hippie drug-taking alcoholism. And that's how I grew up, in this big flat in Notting Hill Gate with people coming and going. Drugs were just all around me. I grew up with smoking dope, acid, everything. And being the youngest child, I was very confused. And also, it was a bit of a... My husband always said it sounds like Tales of the City. It wasn't nearly as glamorous as Tales of the City. It was really sordid. And my mum would, like... We'd have all these people to stay, people who'd been busted from drug dealing, loads of people. And it wasn't fun for a young child growing up in that. It was very confusing and very scary. And I used to look at them, and no one told me what they was doing was illegal. No one said anything was illegal, but I knew. I knew what they did was wrong and illegal. Anyway, that's sort of my start to life, was growing up in surrounded by drugs and alcohol. That was just the way people dealt with their feelings and their emotions. And my mum was as tough as old boots. She was really hard, and you just had to get on with it. You had to get on with anything. I became very good. I was a good girl, and. It's funny, I always felt terribly out of place in my family because my next brother up, he's 8 years older than me, and my older sister, they began to take drugs with my parents. So I was this young child, you know, at 12 and 14, my older brother and sister were taking drugs with my smoking dope, the whole lot, with my stepmother. And stepfather and mother. So it was very confusing, and I felt very kind of out on a limb. And, you know, very, very alone. And then on the weekends, I was quite fortunate, because I would go to visit my father in Stoke Newington and be with him. And he was an alcoholic, actually. He's dead now. And he used to go to the pub every morning at 11 o'clock and stagger back at 2:30, go to sleep and do the same thing every evening. And I the crazy thing was that I'd rather be around him going to the pub than around the drug taking, because somehow, I don't know, it felt more respectable, because I always knew that it was illegal. You know, I when I hear about kids living amongst drugs, I just, my heart goes out to them, because I experienced that. Anyway, so, you know, I sort of shuffled between crazy drug-taking Notting Hill Gate hippie flat to house in Stoke Newington, dad in the pub. And I had a stepmother who actually I became very, very close to, who really, she gave me some parenting. If I ever think back on my life, on how I can be with my kids, I go to her, because she was great. She was lovely. And, you know, she died of cancer a couple of years ago, and I was there, and I nursed her through her death, because I loved her and I wanted to be there for her. She was a fantastic woman. Anyway, sort of life in growing up in Notting Hill with, you know, it sort of... I was very ashamed of my home. Very ashamed, because it, as far as I was concerned, it wasn't like anyone else at school, not at all. And everyone else at school came from nice middle-class homes, and chances are they probably didn't, you know, now I know, but that's what I thought. And I began to, and this project across to people what I wanted them to see, what I thought they would accept. I started lying very, very young. I'd lie about the craziest things, you know, just because I mean, kids, it's very hard to, you know, these days I find it very hard to get in touch with my own feelings anyway. But as a child, I didn't know anything. I just wanted people to like me. So I became the person that you would like. So I thought, you know, and things were difficult. When I was nine, I was, like I said, my mum had all these sort of strange alkies living in the flat and junkies. I was sexually abused by one of the guys that lived in our flat. And what was so crazy is I really liked him. I really liked this man. And when this happened, I never told anyone. I didn't tell anyone. It's you know, I just carried on. In retrospect, I didn't even think, why did he do that? Because he shouldn't have. It was just something that happened, and I just did it, and I went on with it, and I just got on with my life, although it damaged me physically a lot. You know, that was my life growing up, was I didn't tell anybody anything. I told nobody anything, and I just got on with it. And I was a very, very unhappy child. I used to have suicidal thoughts, and you know, I just learned how to adapt and kind of go with the groove, really. And, you know, I was thinking about this on the train. I thought, God, I was actually very talented because I got really into music at primary school. And this is my big claim to fame that I don't mind brandishing about, that I got grade 8 on the recorder by the time I was 11. And that I'm really proud of. I don't play anything now, but that was my big thing, my grade 8. I could teach it. I could go and teach the recorder. But, you know, I had that. I used to throw myself into that, I suppose. I was also really bullied at school. And I remember telling my stepmother, and she came from Willesden, where I live now, actually. And she said, just tell them to shut up. And it was like... You know, it was like asking me to stand naked in assembly or something, doing that. It was impossible. I had no voice at all. I had no voice. And anyway, just kind of fast forwarding a bit, you know, I went off to secondary school, and it was all right, you know. But I became, it was around about, you know, I was very shy, and but also not shy. You know, I could be very fronty and chatty, and because I'd learned how to be very kind of good and chatty and how to get along. But deep down, I suppose, I was very shy and very scared. And I'd always sworn growing up around drugs and alcohol that I would not ever be like my parents, ever. I despised people that smoked dope. I thought dope was just awful. And, you know, it was around about 14. I mean, it's the same story. Everyone's got this same story. I started going out a little bit, you know, meeting boys and all that kind of thing, smoking a few fags. And someone gave me a Cinzano with lemonade. And I can tell you, I remember I drank it, and it just gave me the freedom. Well, it didn't give me freedom. It just, I suppose, it loosened me up. And it just made me feel more alive, I suppose. It was like I was riddled with so much chronic anxiety and self-hate, because no one had ever showed me any form of kind of real unconditional love. Or, you know, I was full of self-hate and fear. I thought, God knows what I thought of myself, actually. You know, and the alcohol just made me feel a bit better. And I honestly can tell you, from that moment on, I started to drink alcoholically. I was the 14-year-old girl that had the vodka and orange in her pocket. I would drink before I went out. You know, because it gave me the confidence to have a good time. I wasn't sitting around scared, you know. It gave me the confidence to let my hair down. And, you know, I started smoking fags and, you know, this, that, you know, it just freed me up. And I also found out that at that point that I was attractive to men, whereas I thought I was so unattractive. You know, I think probably most women in here identify, and most men, that with alcohol, I was, you know, I could do what I wanted to do. And that was get off with boys, sleep with boys. I would sleep with anyone that showed me any affection, not because I wanted it, not because I was into sex, or it was just purely because I just wanted someone to love me. And that's what I thought that you had to do to get someone to love you, was to have sex with them. I didn't know about, no one ever sat me, it was just fucked growing up in that household. So that's what I did. And you know, alcohol soon turned into drugs. I found the first joint in my brother's bedroom. I smoked it all on my own. And probably, it was probably the first and last time I ever enjoyed getting stoned on marijuana. Because for me, after that, marijuana just made me so paranoid that even I stopped smoking it towards the end of my musing, because it was just too much for me. It was just like, oh, I hate that stuff. Anyway, by the time I was 16, I'd been taking all sorts of drugs. I was a bit of a garbage head. I would take anything, you know, Valium and booze, you know. I loved it. It was a good, I thought it was fun. You know, I'd go out and I'd get absolutely smashed, and I didn't think you were drunk or out of it unless you passed out. You know, that was my thing, and I used to, you know, it was, but, you know, deep down, it wasn't fun. I was terribly ashamed as well about how much I used to drink, terribly ashamed, and I was, you know, frightened and scared and all those feelings. Anyway, I'm going to fast forward because my 20 minutes is nearly there and I haven't got to my... by the time I was 19, I was in LA and I hooked up with this guy who was he's 10 years older than me. And I remember seeing him across the room and I thought, Jesus, that guy is going to be dead before he knows it. You know, 2 weeks later, I was living with him in the squalid slum. It was like a shithole in LA in the early 80s. I think it was. I can't remember when it was. Mid 80s. You know, he was dealing coke. And, you know, anyone who, you know, it makes me laugh when people go on about coke being kind of glamorous. This was not glamorous. I spent 2 years living in a kind of subculture in LA of cocaine dealing, alcohol, desperation. You know, he was heavily into porn, and being the I couldn't understand how come that I'm with this guy. Well, now I know, having had to go back and look into my life. You know, my I was sexually abused as a child. It wasn't that strange that I should end up in yet another very abusive situation on that front. And but the crazy thing was, I really loved this guy. You know, it was a mad relationship. It was completely mad. But he was one person. He made me laugh. I loved him. He was great. It was the first really serious relationship I had. It was very, very dangerous for me. I ended up in hospital ODing. I lived in people who've ever been to LA and been in this sort of, that film Boogie Nights really, I don't know if anyone ever saw it, that film really upset me because it reminded me so much of the kind of games we were playing out in LA, me with this guy. And, you know, I never had to worry about where my drugs came from because he sold them, and he sold to lots of people. So he was sort of, but there was never any money. The place we lived in was an absolute shithole. There was cockroaches everywhere all the time. But all the time, the flip side of that was I was desperately trying to look good and be not who I was, that I wasn't really living with him and I wasn't really, you know. Anyway, I think I soon realized my own powerlessness, and trying to stop using and to leave him was just so painful and so difficult. You know, ending up in hospital, Dennis was sharing, you know, I remember ending up in hospital, it was awful, and wondering why the following day I felt so terrible. You know, that's the denial. Like, I OD'd, nearly died, and then I was thinking, why do I feel so bad? You know, why do I feel so bad? Anyway, I'm going to crack on. I knew the only way I was going to get clean was to leave Rick in LA and come back to England. So I did a geographical to get clean. And it was really hard, but I psyched myself up and I came back. I came back to London. And I remember the drinks trolley going down through the, you know, the, and it was clinking. And I was thinking, oh, I was just about to order a vodka and tonic. And then I thought, no, I don't do that anymore. And I didn't. And I came back, and my brother, who I'd found out about NA actually through my brother, who'd got clean in NA, and he was here. So I thought, right, I'm going to go to meetings. So I started, but the funny thing is, I could admit my powerlessness over alcohol, but I didn't think I was an addict, because although I'd used so many drugs, I hadn't used needles. And you were only an addict if you used needles. You had to be really, you know, syringes, and therefore I wasn't. And, you know, I kept coming to NA meetings, and I have to say it was very, very difficult at first, because I was so scared and I was so nervous, but I knew that I had to stay clean, and I knew if I went back into using, it would just be one phone call and I would be back to in LA. I just knew it. I just knew that. And I kept coming to these meetings, and I slowly began, my denial around drugs began to crack. You know, fortunately, I just knew, I just never wanted to use again. I never wanted to drink again, because I knew that one is too many and 1,000 never enough. I knew that. God, did I know that. The dangerous places where I've been through my own alcoholism and drug addiction, it's quite shocking. But so I kept coming to meetings. It was scary. And one thing, I'm really going to say this in my chair, is anonymity is so important, because I came into the fellowship and I was James's little sister. And it was like, fuck, I just wanted to be me. I didn't want to be anyone's little sister. And I was in another fellowship, and some woman was talking about anonymity, and it kind of really clicked with me that it wasn't just, oh, because I saw Kate Moss in it, you know what I mean? It's not that. It's about letting that person be who they are without anyone knowing that their background is, where they come from, whether they're a famous pot, just letting them be and tell their story. And I found that hard, actually. And, you know, being, because I wanted just to, and I was constrained by all my family stuff as well. That was hard. Anyway, I got a sponsor, and she was great. I don't know where she is now. And, you know, I did step one, and I just kept coming to meetings. And I went to women's meetings, love women's meetings, still really love women's meetings, made friends, and I didn't use a day at a time. There were times when I really wanted to use. I even made a connection with my ex-boyfriend in America. I was calling him up. Every time I got low, I'd phone him up. He'd say, come back. And I was like, oh, I don't know. And then it was funny enough, I was in Hampstead, and I heard someone do a step three chair. And it was about shutting all the doors, about making a commitment to recovery. And I thought, I've still got that back door open, because I was phoning my ex-boyfriend. And I knew then that I had to shut the door and go for it. And it was very freeing. It was a very freeing experience to let go and commit myself. And I did. You know, I did, and it hasn't, you know, it, I found honesty very difficult, because I think in the early days, I just didn't know what was going on. To be honest, I had no idea. I mean, with myself, my own emotions. I was full of so many difficult feelings, but I didn't know what feelings were. I knew about being terribly unhappy or angry, but the sort of, or happy, but the kind of wishy-washy, difficult stuff that was coming up was very, very hard to deal with. And sometimes I didn't know how to share in meetings, but I just kept turning up and sharing when I could, sharing with my friends, sharing with my sponsor. You know, I'm a very obsessive person, actually. I use obsession to avoid my stuff, and I became, you know, I had a lot of obsessions with different blokes in the fellowship, and at times that was fun, and at times it was really painful. But I just kept, you know, talking about things, and people would show me the way. When I was 2.5 years clean, I met a guy in recovery who I started going out with, and he was great, really nice guy. Very angry, actually, but so was I. But he was able to express his anger. I was much more passive with mine. And we got together, and we had a child together. I was 25 or 4 when I had a baby. And he and I had a very turbulent relationship, in as much as that he started using again. And we were on and off. It was very hard, because I really cared about him. I did really love him. He was a great guy. And we had this gorgeous child together. And we didn't live together. I moved to this flat in Tottenham, and he would be using gear and not. And that, I have to say, was such a difficult time, because it was around about 3 years clean. And he was using, and my closest friend had started drinking again. And a lot of his friends who I was friendly with, they would have all started using. And my this great friend of mine who I really loved, she was using. And I was so lonely. So much of me wanted to be with these two. But I just didn't want to go back there. I just didn't want what using had. I just knew the only way forward was to stay clean and just keep walking down this path. Anyway, a terrible tragedy happened. We were back and forth together, and you know, I took him back. He went in treatment. La 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 la. And I was looking at him one time, I was thinking, are you pinned? Are you not pinned? And he said, I've been using. And it was like, it was over. It wasn't over because he'd been using, because I'd been back and forth with him while he had been using. It was over. It was just finished. I'd had enough. It's like, you know, I'm a great believer in not, you know, I always feel that kind of my recovery is, well, it's a bit like a football. If you hold it, if you're a football in a swimming pool and you're holding it underwater, it always wants to bounce up. You know, it's a bit like white knuckling. It keeps trying to bounce up. And it's not until you can let it go that you can, you're free. And this relationship just kind of came to an end. I let it run its course. It ran its course without me trying to control it. Because believe me, I did try and control him getting clean. Oh my God, did I threaten? I did everything. But when I just thought, no, I love him. I'm going to be with him. I don't care. And then it came to the point where I did care. I loved him, but I didn't want to stay with him while he was. It was over. You know, it was too late. It was too late. It was finished. And 3 days after that, our son died. Very, very, very tragically of meningitis. That's why I was at this bereavement thing. You know, one minute he was well, and the next minute he was in St. Mary's Hospital, and he was going to, you know, I knew he was going to die, actually. And he died within 24 hours of contracting this hideous, hideous disease. And I remember I walked, you know, it was over with John. My son had died. I was about 5.5 years clean, actually. And I felt like I'd been hit by a truck. I felt like, you know, it was a really hot, sunny day. And I felt like I'd just, you know, one minute I had this life where I was, you know, I had this lovely baby, you know, I went to meetings, da, 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 da. Next minute it was just like smashed. It was absolutely horrific. You know, and I had to, but the crazy thing was, I didn't want to use, you know. I remember the woman, my beautiful son, who was 2.5 at the time when he died, was laying out on the bed, and the intensive care nurse, she said, do you want a drink? I said, no. I said, no. God, no. And she said, did you have a problem? Did you have a problem with, I don't know how she knew, drugs and alcohol? And I said, yeah. And I've been clean for however long it was, and I'm not going to start using now. Because the pain was so hideous and so intense. The idea of putting using in the mix was just like, oh, fucking hell. No, I couldn't cope with that. And, you know, I had to, I didn't even start smoking again. I didn't even pick up a fag, you know. So I just carried on. I kept walking, and you know, I've had various sponsors, and I'm really aware that I haven't talked about my step work, but I'll come to that in a minute. You know, and I just kept going, sharing, and it was really hard. It was so hard, and it still really is very painful, dealing with emotions surrounding the death of him. But, you know, I look back and I think about Gus, my son that died, and my relationship with John, and the things that both of them, they taught me. I mean, I kind of think, God, that relationship really wasn't meant to go anywhere, because not only did our relationship not work, but the sort of child, the product of it, died. But you know, I learned a lot from John. I shouldn't say his name. I learned a lot from him. He was great, possibly one of the most talented people artistically I'd ever met. But I learned that, you know, I used to be like so controlling in relationships, and so like, if you didn't do the washing up, it was over. You know, I learned, you know, I was so kind of resentful about what he wasn't, rather than I learned to really appreciate what he was. And you know, and I learned a lot from that relationship. And it wasn't long after my little boy who died, I met my husband, actually. And it was funny because I was praying. I said, I really want to meet a boyfriend that I really fancy and that I fall in love with, right? I actually prayed for that. And on Christmas Day of 1992, I went to this Christmas party, which I actually really didn't want to go to, but I went to it because I was very low that day. It was the first, you know, it was Christmas without my son. It was, you know, and he was there, and I remember my friend of mine fancied him, so, you know, I didn't think, well, you don't go fancy your mate's friend who you fancy, you know. But then he phoned me up and asked me out. And what was so fantastic about my relationship with my husband, he was the first person, he knew about grief. He'd lost his mother when he was a child, and his best mate had died. And he was able to hold me in my pain and, you know, really, really support me. And, you know, we're so lucky because I feel so grateful that I have him, because, you know, I prayed for him and he came, and we've grown together. We've been together 12 years now, and I've got 3 fantastic children who are so gorgeous, and my husband's been away for a week in America, and I was sleeping with the little 5-year-old, and I was holding him, and I was thinking, you know, I've had someone I love, really love, die, where, you know, my child. And you can I was feeling the life in Teddy, and you know, and I was so grateful that I had him and my other children and my husband. I feel so lucky to have them in my life, because we have grown together, and I've got these three great kids, and you know, I do feel very grateful. I mean, I'm going to be all programmy, talk about the steps. I'm a great believer in the steps. I'm actually just going through them again. I mean, I'm going through them again with a friend. We're kind of co-sponsoring each other this time, and we did a step one, which was very powerful. Step two, and I've just recently done a step three, which was amazing, because we decided we'd write. We looked at the step three prayer, and we thought we'd write a prayer each based around this step three prayer, and we committed that we'd say this prayer each, every evening and every night ourselves, you know, before we start on our step four. And you know, it just ceases to amaze me how it works, because I felt like I really was, you know, because sometimes I think, oh yeah, here we go again, you know, what a load of rubbish, because there's that real cynic in me, you know. I don't think there's anyone in here who doesn't really think, have moments like that. But it kind of, I really felt like I was giving my will and my life to God, and I really feel I'm on another stage again of having to deal with stuff, you know, that, and it actually, I got in touch with a hell of a lot of pain after this step three, because I've been, you know, I can be on the run. I can use doing too much to avoid my feelings. I'm a real workaholic. This, pack my days in so I'm knackered and exhausted, you know, so I don't have to feel my stuff. But this step three, I felt like I was really letting go of some of that stuff. And, you know, and I have been feeling a lot of pain recently, a hell of a lot. And I'm trying to deal with stuff around my abuse issues, which is very, very painful, and God, it's affected me in so many ways. But I try and deal with it on a daily, you know, daily basis. I try and cope with my emotions. I feel so grateful that I've got the program, because I've got some very close friends who help me. I don't know where I'd be without it, actually, because it is the backbone of my life. It holds me up and keeps me going. And have I got to finish soon? Three minutes. It is the kind of backbone that keeps me walking forward every day. Yeah, and my hopes for the future, my experience, my strengths, and my hopes. I hope for the future. I just really want to really, really get rid of the shit that tells me I'm no good, that's still there, that keeps holding me back, that tells me I can't do a chair for 40 minutes, that makes me write notes which I haven't even looked at, you know, that holds me back, that tells me I'm crap. You know, I would love to be free of that stuff. I really would. And I'd also, you know, I want to have a relationship with my children. Like my, I'm having a bit of a tough time with my 12-year-old. She's just gone to secondary school, and it's really painful because I'm terrified she's going to end up with the, you know, smoking 40 B&H around the corner with the girls, you know, and getting pissed and doing all the things that I did. And, you know, I'm just really, it's really, really bringing out loads of that stuff for me. And I'm having to trust that she's not me. You know, maybe she's all right. Maybe her self-esteem isn't on the floor like mine was. But that's quite hard for me, because I do think I know everything and I can control it, if I'm honest. That's what I'm working on. Letting go and trusting and my health. Taking care, trying to take better care of myself so that I can really appreciate and enjoy all that I have been given. Thanks.